When the white smoke billowed from the chimney in St. Peter's Square, I leaned in towards the television, watching the live announcement of the new Pope. His name is Robert Francis Prevost, announced the RTE correspondent. Scenes of the crowd followed, cheering, crying, waving flags, as a calm man in red robes stepped onto the balcony and gazed down at the people below and out to the watching world. I turned to my daughter, who was sitting beside me. I know him, I said. Who? She asked. That priest, the Pope, I know him. And so I began my story. It was September 2004. I had just turned 25 and had flown to Rome with my fiancé to get married at the Pontifical Irish College, a beautiful oasis tucked behind tall black gates on the Via de Santi Quattro. It was a popular place for Irish couples to wed. When we arrived, we were greeted, not by the stern, elderly Italian priest, as I had imagined, but by a warm, smiling American with a soft voice. You can call me Father Rob, he said. He was from Chicago. I was surprised, but pleasantly so. Father Rob welcomed us in, and the ceremony began. Afterwards, we stepped out into the sunlit grounds of the Irish College, where we posed for photos on the stone steps in front of palm trees and lush plants. My parents and new in-laws stood beside us, all of us lining up with Father Rob as the college's resident photographer captured the moment. I wore a simple dress I'd bought from Debenhams in Belfast. I stood there beaming, feeling like my whole life was just beginning. Father Rob walked over to me and leaned in. So where are you guys going for your wedding dinner? He asked, glancing towards our chattering parents. Oh, I said, suddenly realising there was nothing booked. Yes, unlike many brides who micromanage every detail of their big day, from monogrammed napkins to colour-coded seating charts, I had forgotten to even arrange a wedding meal, completely. Father Rob smiled, then chuckled, and gently placed a hand on my shoulder. Tell you what, he said, would you like me to make a call and book somewhere lovely? I know the perfect little place. Yes, please, I said, flooded with relief. And how will we get there, I asked. Don't worry, he beamed, I'll take care of everything. The heat was rising and people were starting to get hungry and restless. Then, like a scene from a movie, two sleek black cars pulled up in front of the church and Father Rob extended his arms dramatically. Your carriages await. We all laughed and climbed in, Father Rob included, and began our drive out of the ancient city. We passed the Colosseum, weaving through the chaotic Roman traffic, and there I was, a brand new bride, on her way to a wedding reception I hadn't planned, all arranged by Father Rob. We left the city and drove up a tree-lined hill, arriving at a beautiful restaurant nestled among Rome's grassy hilltops. Inside, long tables were dressed in starched white linens. Polished silver cutlery and bunches of roses decked the tabletops. We were seated and food began to arrive. Delicious course after course. Cold meat platters with smoked cheese and olives on wooden boards. Fresh pastas, sliced boiled eggs, salads drizzled in local olive oil and grilled fish. This followed by square plates of creamy tiramisu and pear and almond tarts. Red wine and water flowed freely. The room filled with laughter and we ate like kings. I recall the restaurant roof being made of transparent perspex, with water from hose pipes cascading over it to keep the space cool. Father Rob mingled with others in the restaurant and then sat among us, sharing stories of his work in Rome. We exchanged tales of our own lives in Ireland. The high noon sun lowered in the sky. My father paid the bill and we all left happy. When we finally returned to our hotel, my new mother-in-law held onto my arm and said, impressed, "You picked the most beautiful spot for your wedding dinner." I smiled and said nothing. As I told this story, my daughter was listening intrigued. "So that's him," she asked, clearly amazed, pointing at the television screen as the new Pope stood proud and composed on the Vatican balcony. "That's right," I said. "Father Rob, the priest from my wedding day, is now Pope Leo XIV. Who would have thought? I rang my parents who were watching the live announcement as well. We had a good laugh remembering how, on a hilltop in Rome, we'd unknowingly dined with the future Pope. We also joked about how I hadn't even booked a wedding meal. Some things never change, commented my daughter. 21 years later, 5 beautiful children fill my kitchen with joy and laughter, and I'm also warmed by the memory of a selfless act of kindness. A man who saw a young girl who needed a little help on her wedding day stepped in without drama and simply made everything better, with quiet confidence, genuine care, and a little style. Thank you, Father Rob, or rather, Your Holiness, and congratulations on becoming the new Pope.
We're all familiar with the concept of something being lost in translation, but it's only in the actual act of translation that we understand exactly what it means. Perhaps the phrase lost in translation is itself lost in translation, or at least in banality. When I speak to Italian audiences, I always choose a simple, everyday example. One of my favourites is the expression, ci mancherebbe. You say ci mancherebbe when someone says thank you, for holding the door open for them, for buying them a coffee, for giving them directions. They say grazie, and you reply, ci mancherebbe. So we know what it means. It's an approximate equivalent of you're welcome or don't mention it. But the Italian phrase has a warmth in its soft ci and a faint lingering on the double B at the end of mancherebbe that your welcome doesn't have. Now, I generally lose Italians at this point because it is, after all, a common everyday phrase for them. They don't think about it any more than we do about our equivalent. Lost in banality, perhaps. The problem for me is that ci mancherebbe cannot be translated literally. It means we would miss it. So I say thank you and you reply we would miss it. It makes no sense in English. And indeed, when you probe it, it makes no sense to Italians either. I remember once asking a translator friend about it and she replied, but it's just the same as figurati. And figurati, which translates as you can imagine or imagine it, is even weirder. Yet it too is an everyday expression. A good Irish example is our phrase, a soft day. What we mean is that it's raining very lightly, or it's humid to the point of being almost raining. It's not cold. It's not that kind of rain that comes with an east wind, which gives rise to the Irish expression, Tashag kurfirkna ishkana, it's raining knives and forks. Or as the English would say, it's raining cats and dogs. Though what the cats and dogs have to do with it is anybody's guess. Given English people's devotion to pets, I would have thought raining cats and dogs would be a good thing. Knives and forks, however, is a kind of rain we can feel on our skin. That bitter easterly wind blowing rain cold enough to be hail straight into our faces. But a soft day is a different matter. It may even be a bit close, another untranslatable expression. Now, how to explain to an Italian that it's a soft day? You can't say una giornata morbida, the direct translation, though you can talk about una giornata dolce, which means a sweet day, but really can't be used to refer to rain. For the Italians, for the most part, rain and humidity mean cold. Perhaps it's a relative thing. In Ireland, if you're used to our winters, a day of light rain with a moderate temperature is surely soft. For an Italian, it's a catastrophe, because the climate is generally much more dolce. So ultimately, it's not complex philosophical or scientific terms which are hard to translate. They have their precise equivalents. It's the simplest phrases. The things we understand instinctively, partly by tone, partly by expression, and partly by context. Another example. I've tried for years to translate an Irish song called An Bhfeidhm Mhara into English. Let's just take the title. An Bhfeidhm Mhara is usually translated as The Mermaid. But what do you think of when you think of mermaids? A woman with a fish's tail? Not useful. Perhaps the sea maiden would be a better version, or the sea woman, because in the song, the woman has two children. There is, in the three verses we usually hear, no mention of a husband. It's a song that speaks to us directly, like all songs, partly through its beautiful air and partly through the simplicity and directness of the words, in particular through the direct affection the woman expresses for her children. She calls them, Mavoire Vrinel is my father born. I'm going to pass over the difficulty of rendering that beautiful word Brinel into English, beyond saying that it is usually translated as maiden or fair maiden, and I'm going to look at the expression of affection in Padraig Bán. Bán, as anyone who speaks even a little Irish will know, literally means white, but here it is an expression of affection. Oscoelge, if you refer to someone as a Buachil Bán or a Colleen Bán, you mean a favourite boy or son or a favourite girl or daughter. Hence the name of the Busico play, the Colleen Bán. A bán can also be an unploughed meadow, but that's another story altogether. Now, how do I tell someone that in Irish, to call someone white means to say you love them? It hardly works in this age of white privilege. Yet there it is. A single, simple, beautiful word in a beautiful song that has absolutely no equivalent in the English language. And here I have to say, it is I who am lost in translation.
I remember it clearly. A Friday night in the late 1980s, I got the bus from Dublin to Galway with the firm intention that this was going to be the weekend. I would finally come out to my family and friends back home in the West. But as I travelled through Kildare, Meath, Westmeath, Roscommon and into Galway, that certainty ebbed away. By the time I was home, I no longer felt brave enough to tell my truth. I grew up in the west of Ireland in the 1970s and 80s, a time when the word gay was almost unknown. Queer was the word we used then, and even more undesirable terms. It was a term of abuse, shouted in classrooms and on pitches. In 1986, I moved to Dublin. There weren't many gay places back then, but there were some. It was a clandestine existence for many, where it was not possible to be out at work or highly visible on the street. A time of fear in the gay community. The new disease of AIDS had hit the headlines, and videos of falling tombstones were terrifying all of us young gay men. But over time, like many, I became more comfortable with being gay and expressing that as part of my life in Dublin. However, when I went home to the West, I felt the need to hide myself once again. Eventually, I did come out at home in 1993, the same year homosexuality was decriminalised. This was also the year when I first walked in a pride parade in Dublin. There were perhaps 300 people on that parade. We all stood at the top of Parnell Square outside the Garden of Remembrance, on the footpath without disturbing the traffic. Yet we were spotted, and some people covered the eyes of their children and spat at us from buses. As we walked up Collins Street, there were more gay people I recognised watching from the crowd than walking in the march. Like many others, I became an activist to fight for change, ending up as co-chair of the Labour Party LGBT group. In 2007, the government promised to legislate for civil partnership. It was controversial in the gay community. Some saw it as a stepping stone to full equality, while others saw it as continued discrimination. And so, a referendum was promised to change the constitution in order to allow for same-sex marriage. The date was set for 22nd of May 2015. I voted early that morning at 7 a.m. I was rushing for a train to a wedding in Mayo. Ironically, this was the first civil wedding I had attended in Ireland. A sign of the times, perhaps. It was a joyous celebration of second chances. So many changes in such a short space of time. The following day, I was on the train from Castlebar to Dublin, listening to the radio as the results started to roll in. Dublin Bay South says yes. Loud says yes. Meath says yes. Cork says yes. Yes, yes, yes. County after county, constituency after constituency voted yes. I travelled once again through Roscommon, Westmeath, Meath, Kildare, and then into Dublin, this journey I had done 1,000 times before. I remembered the day where, travelling in the opposite direction, I'd lost my will and bravery with every stop on the way home, unable to be my true self. But this day was different. This day, as we returned to Dublin, more and more people boarded the train at every station with rainbow flags. An air of celebration and catharsis grew to a frenzy. By the time we arrived at Euston Station, it was like a pride parade. However, this time there weren't 300 people. There were thousands, all walking to one place, Dublin Castle. I walked with them, and we poured into the sunny square and waited for the results to be announced. It felt like the whole country was there. Politicians, celebrities, and all the gay personalities we had ever known. Campaigners and activists, and all those people who thought it would never happen. The journey that day from the west of Ireland wasn't just a train journey. It was a journey through time. A journey from a different place and an utterly different world. From a place which never really felt like home. Never really welcomed us as full citizens, visible and loved for who we are and who we were. No, it wasn't just a train journey. This was a journey home. Finally, we were home. And we all know there's no place like home.
One of my earliest memories is of sitting cross-legged on the floor in my grandparents' sitting room in 1970, waiting for the Eurovision Song Contest to begin. I was 4 3/4 and allowed to stay up very late to see 19-year-old Dana representing Ireland in Amsterdam. For weeks, I'd been singing all kinds of everything to my ever-patient granny and granddad, who indulged me every time and sang along. I sat there in front of the telly, a glass of red lemonade and a plate of the good biscuits beside me. Remember the ones with the jelly star on top? My grandparents were my favourite people in the world. I was their first grandchild. The feeling of being adored, safe and loved, that is what I remember most about them. My granny was the boss and she could be a tough cookie. But my granddad adored her and his warm brown eyes lit up any time she walked into the room. I had my own bedroom in their house, a floral landscape of pink and blue wallpaper, a red box record player on the floor, one of those with the lid that turned it into a suitcase, and a small stack of vinyl records that for an almost 5-year-old girl was quite impressive. Joe Dolan's House with the Whitewash Gable was second only to Dana's All Kinds of Everything as my most prized possession. Above the bed was a shelf my granddad had made to allow me to display my collection of tiny dolls from around the world. These little dolls, no more than 4 inches tall, and all in their respective countries' traditional costumes, stood proudly in their tiny plastic cases. France, Spain, China, India, all represented beautifully in miniature. Every Sunday after Mass, Granny would take me to Salmon's on Main Street in Ballinasloe, where she'd buy me either a new vinyl 45 or a miniature doll. For a child in 1970s Ireland, this was indeed a wonderful treat. The dolls from all over the world were allowed downstairs to watch the Eurovision Song Contest that year. After all, they had to see how their own countries fared in the competition. I lined them up along the sofa so they could have a good view of the telly. 19-year-old Dana was the last of the 12 acts to perform that night. She walked out on stage wearing a simple white embroidered mini dress, her long dark hair loose around her shoulders and her brown eyes sparkling. I was enthralled. I remember my granny remarking how she was very composed and didn't look even a bit nervous. Dana perched on a stool. The orchestra played the opening bars and I hardly dared to breathe until she finished the song to rapturous applause. Dana won, of course. The simple ballad All Kinds of Everything became a worldwide hit and the teenager from Derry with the angelic voice became a superstar. Although the Eurovision Song Contest has changed beyond all recognition, it will forever remind me of my granny and granddad that night in March 1970. A nation held its breath for the teenage girl sitting demurely on a stool singing for her country, while a 4 3/4-year-old girl sang every word along with her. In later years, of course, Ireland would go on to win the Eurovision 7 times in total, and 10 years later, Johnny Logan became my teenage obsession. Posters of him in his white suit, singing What's Another Year, covered my bedroom walls. The Red Box record player survives to this day. The collection of vinyl records now preserved in frames adorning the walls of my music room. What I wouldn't give for just a brief spin back to Granny's house in the 1970s. Just to hug them both one more time and tell them that I adored them as much as they adored me. And that the love for music they gave me has stayed with me to this day.
It was exactly a decade ago, and I would ask the question of anyone who would listen. What, I would ask, what could be sad about an empty nest? Why isn't the empty nest syndrome a shorthand for joy? I would elaborate that the bird watching websites explained that sometime, very early in the morning, when the blue-tit nestlings were coming up to 3 weeks old, they would leave the bird box by the little hole in the front, take their first flight, and never return. They warned me that it would be over in a matter of moments, and I was unlikely to see it for myself. So, it was about 8 in the morning, and I was standing at the kitchen sink, sunlight glancing off the suds, yellow rubber gloves searching the basin for the last things to be washed, when the garden filled up with an exhilarated, insistent, urging birdsong. Yellow gloves held aloft, I ran to the back door to see what the commotion was all about. 1, 2, 3, 4 blue-tit fledglings catapulted from the bird box, somehow knew to fly to the right towards the birch tree, and tumbled down through the twigs and branches until their new claws grasped a perch for the very first time and they joined the singing. I couldn't smile widely enough to express my joy. As I watched, I remembered the first time I realised in early spring that a pair of blue tits were bringing building materials in and out of what I thought was a garden ornament crudely tied to the fence, but they saw as home. By May, I reckoned the eggs had hatched, and each morning I scanned the sky to see if the parents had survived the night, waiting to see them making their scooping flight across the neighbours' hedges, back to the fence, where they perched above the nest box, checking all round before ducking in the entrance and ducking out again, back and forth, back and forth. As hatchlings turned to nestlings, I would bring my coffee out in the morning sunshine to listen to the peep, peep, peep of the hungry chicks. I was never alone in my vigil. A mischief of magpies lined the roof ridge of the house opposite, one hopping foot to foot with impatience. The neighbourhood cats were attracted to the garden like filings to a magnet, parading the perimeter with predatory intent. And still the busy parents went back and forth, back and forth. All those mornings ago, that exuberant song of those first flights lasted only minutes. And then the garden fell into a deep silence. But the air was still reverberating with hope and promise. How could anyone describe an empty nest with a glum face? Now, this is my first spring as an empty nester myself. The cat now lolls in the hush of my daughter's old childhood bedroom. Yes, there is the joy of watching a young life take shape and find its place in the world, but there's also a counterweight, the ache of missing that trusting little hand in mine, the gentle grief of recognising the changing seasons of my own life, and perhaps, too, a kind of fear. You see, weeks after the nestlings fledged all those years ago, I decided to clean out the bird box in the hope that the next year, another pair of blue tits would make it home. I carefully removed the box from the fence. Opening the bigger door at the back, I could see the carefully woven moss, grass and down that created the soft bed of the nest, and how it was trimmed with a cosy collar of dog hair. As I gently pulled it out of the box and into the light, I saw, cupped at the bottom of the nest, one small, lifeless blue tit, its head turned to one side, a wing extended, with shiny black flight feathers perfectly formed, a bib of yellow fluff on its chest. What had happened to this bird on that glorious early summer morning? As the birdsong rang around the garden, why didn't he leave? Did he not understand that call, that it was time to fly, that the nestling had to become a fledgling? Then I better understood the empty nest syndrome. It is the joy, of course. It is the ache of loss. It is the grief of aging. But it's also a kind of helplessness. On that bright June morning, it is the chick alone that can recognise the call to life, and it alone can answer, testing those flight feathers and resolutely flying out into the unknown world.
In 1949, just 4 years after the Second World War, a young German woman from the Rhineland came to Ireland. Her name was Irmgard Kaiser. She met a man from West Cork named Sean O'Hermelty, and they got married a year later in her hometown of Kempen. In 1951, she crossed the Irish Sea once more, expecting a baby. She stepped off the mailboat in Dunleary and made her way up to a red-bricked house in Glenageary, number 2 Spencer Villas. She stood in the hallway, just inside the door, and was instantly homesick. This might have been a big mistake, to go and live in a foreign country where everything was so strange. She considered running away, back to Germany, but then she prayed and unpacked her suitcase and got busy. The baby was born in October, a boy. She named him after her father, Franz Kaiser, and from that moment onwards, she knew this was no mistake. She was still homesick, but also very much aware how much you could be made welcome by a child. Her home was where her baby boy, Franz, learned to walk across the kitchen floor. Franzchen, she called him. He was born with a talent for making things right. He picked up those traits that his mother brought with her from Germany, her humour, her storytelling, her ability to put the dark things behind her, that instinctive gift for helping people, what can only be called a conspiracy of kindness. He became a great carpenter. He would arrive with his tools in a homemade trolley pulled at the back of his bike. His work was inventive. Some of the things he assembled could only be called witty. They made you laugh. In a larder in Spencer Villas, there was no space for a large steel pot, so he built a dedicated shelf close to the ceiling, a rounded platform that was more like a lookout tower on the mast of a ship. He solved a leak in the roof by converting a wedding present, an ornamental water feature, into an ingenious cistern, pumping the rainwater away into a gutter. There is a photograph of my brother Franz as a boy at the seafront, wearing German lederhosen and an Irish iron sweater, half German, half Irish. And because we were prohibited by our father from speaking English, only Irish and German allowed in the house, his way of dealing with that confusion was to develop a beautiful formality in English. He would use phrases like, in due course. With regard to that job, I will be able to commence on Monday. He lived his life in translation. He dreamed in German. He sang in Irish. He bought his wood in English. His love of the Irish language began when we were sent to Connemara for 3 months to become fully Irish. He was 10, I was 9. He stayed in the house of the postman in Onchiarurua, and I lived with a family in Ballandangan. We sent each other letters. I went to visit him when I was homesick. I walked into Carurua and sat with him for a while on the wall of the school, sharing a packet of fruit gums. Chanimid fruit gums the shuppe, agus cahamar tamil a sír a mála lasmud an scoil. Hiúr mé rásca bél an dangan, agus níra mé uignag a hile. When we were small, our mother often rewarded our achievements with a box of Smarties. When he recently had a hip operation, I sent him a WhatsApp message in her words. Ach, Fränzchen, jetzt bekommst du eine Packung Smarties. A few days later, I called over to him with a box of Smarties to help him recover. The weather was warm the day he died. He said he never felt better. He had a piece of cake that his sister Ita brought him, and later that evening he went to his singing lesson. He had taken up Shannos singing in Monkstown and managed to learn two verses of a little-known version of Slievna Mon. He made it home on his bike. His wife Jennifer said he had a great smile coming in the door. He collapsed in the hallway from a heart attack. He died at the peak of his happiness, in that very place where his mother once stood with such doubt and where he made her feel so welcome. Auf Wiedersehen, Franz. Good day to Sloan. We're all homesick now, Frank. We cry in German. We laugh in Irish. We are still a bit lost in English, but very much among friends. Every door will remember you smiling. The streets will remember you on your bike. The coast, the rocks, the harbour, the lighthouse. The sea will remember you sailing with the wind at your back.
On this morning's programme, we heard Dining with the Pope by Grainne Quinlan, Lost in Translation by William Wall, There's No Place Like Home by Fabian McGrath, All Kinds of Everything was by Joan Shields, Empty Nest by Eileen Herron, and Franz by Hugo Hamilton. The music was Libiamo from Verdi's La Traviata, sung by Leslie Garrett and John Hudson with London Voices and the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Peter Robinson. Un Vaiden Vara by Alton. Here Comes the Sun by George Harrison, performed by Nina Simone. All Kinds of Everything by Derry Lindsay and Jackie Smith, sung by Dana at the 1970 Eurovision. The live RTE commentary was by Valerie McGovern. And Blackbird by The Beatles. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back on the RTE radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.